This is Solve It for Kids.
Hello, my amazing and curious friends. My name is Jennifer, and this is Solve It for Kids, the podcast that gives kids and families a peek inside the real world of scientists, engineers, and experts as they solve problems in their jobs using creativity, cooperation, and critical thinking. And now please welcome to the show my podcast partner, Galactic Space Geek, Jeff Gagne.
Hello, Jennifer, and hello, listeners. And everybody get ready for Jen to get excited and for us to get wet again, because we are going into the ocean.
Oh, this is so exciting. What problem are we solving today?
How do you design a sensor to learn about the deep ocean?
How can you design a sensor to learn about the deep ocean? Ooh, this sounds very intriguing. And can I guess maybe a little bit of engineering is involved? Who is our guest today, Jeff?
Actually, it's going to be a lot of bit of engineering. Today we get to talk to the very special Dr. Anna Michelle, who is Associate Scientist of the Department of Applied Ocean Physics and Engineering at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution.
Welcome to the show, Dr. Anna.
Thank you for having me.
This is so exciting to have another ocean person on the show, because we've been having a lot of space, and the ocean is such a fascinating place. So I'm going to start with kind of an easy one. How did you decide you wanted to get into studying the ocean?
Well, I grew up in Florida. I grew up in a town called Sarasota, which is a beach town.
Yes.
And there's a marine lab there. So that kind of sparked my interest originally. But then I was very lucky as a high school student. I was able to participate in a cruise with Dr. Robert Ballard, who discovered the Titanic.
Wow.
He set up these live shows. Students could go to museums and see live exploration. But every year he also took some students out on a cruise. So in high school, I went on a research cruise to the Galapagos Islands. And I asked, how do you get to do this for a living?
And the answer was, exactly.
Study engineering. So I was sold.
That is absolutely cool.
Yes.
What I have to follow that up. What did you do on that cruise? Because you were just a high school student, right?
I was just a high school student. And unfortunately, the barge that was carrying all the equipment to the Galapagos, including the remotely operated vehicle at the time, which was called Jason Jr., sunk on the way to the islands.
Oh my gosh.
All of their equipment, all of the satellite infrastructure, everything was lost. So they had to quickly scramble to get all of this gear to do the project anyway. So
We
stayed on a small dive boat and we went to different islands and we got to see the animals and get to go snorkeling, and they brought small ROVs. And so we got to participate and just learn about these kind of careers and about the Galapagos Islands, and we got to drive the ROVs. And I was just amazed that this was even a career choice, that you could work with an underwater robot.
Well, and talk about solving problems right away. All of your equipment literally sunk into the ocean, and that had to get solved.
That is correct.
Wow. Okay, so tell us about operating an ROV. Tell us what it is, maybe for our listeners that don't know. And then tell us about how cool it is, I would imagine.
So an ROV is a remotely operated vehicle. So it's a robot that's tethered to a ship. So it's connected to the ship, which means that you can sit on the ship and drive it. Some of the pilots say it's a little bit like a video game. You have a joystick, you get to drive it around. So if you've got good video game experience, you can be an ROV pilot. So I don't myself drive the ROV. What my group does is we develop instruments that we put on the ROV so we can make measurements in the ocean. But what we get to do is sit in a room where all the video from the ROV is being transmitted back to the ship.
Uh-huh.
So we can see where the robot is. We can see what the robot is seeing. We can tell the pilots, hey, let's go over there. Let's do these kind of measurements. And so it's kind of like we're on the bottom of the ocean, but we're sitting on the dry ship.
That is,
and it's
so
all
cool.
Real time, correct?
It's all real time.
That's very cool, because you don't have to just program it to do what you want it to do. Like you were just saying, like, hey, let's go over there. If you see something down there in the cameras that isn't
wasn't maybe part of the plan, you can adjust the plan and make those tweaks.
That's correct. And also, because we have satellites, we can actually beam the video back. So people on shore can actually participate by sitting at their computer or going to certain places where they're beaming the video back. And they can actually see the live video from the robot back on shore also.
That is so cool. So the next question is, what are you looking for? I mean, is there anything specific, or you're just looking around to see what's there?
So that's a great question. So sometimes we are just looking. We're really curious. We want to explore. We want to find out what's there. Other times we have really targeted sites where we know there's something there and we want to go and understand what's happening there. So, you know, we always work with a big team of scientists. So we bring biologists, geologists, chemists. My lab itself, we work a lot with greenhouse gases. So we measure methane and carbon dioxide in these environments.
Right.
We're looking at places where fluids are coming out of the ocean, for example.
And then you want to test the fluids? I mean, what are you looking for with that?
We want to know what's in the fluids. So we want to try to understand what's happening in these environments. Sometimes we go to places as kind of a test bed. So we'll bring an instrument where we know there's a certain chemical and we want to see how well our instruments work. So that way we can give instruments to other scientists who want to learn more about different places.
That makes sense.
That makes a lot of sense. With these instruments, are you going always to the same depth or about the same depth? Or do your depths vary greatly?
That's a great question. So it depends where we're working. So some sites are really deep. We'll work at, say, 4,000 meters. Other times we'll work at much shallower, say 100 meters. The Jason ROV is rated to 6,500 meters. So it can work really deep.
Oh my gosh.
Wow.
It really depends.
Listeners, you got to do the math on that.
Very deep. So it takes hours for the vehicle to even get to the bottom and then do the science and then come back up because it's a long way down. Wow. But we can work in these really deep environments. So everything we design has to work in these deep environments, which means we have to be careful because there's very high pressure. So everything has to be designed in special housings that can withstand the pressure of those depths.
Right. So that kind of leads into where what I want to ask about next, because you're an engineer, which most people think, she works in the ocean, she's a marine scientist. But you're an ocean engineer. Explain to me what that is and what you do with that.
That's right. And, you know, we think about people work in the ocean and we think that they all work on animals. So they all study the animals.
Yes.
But that's not true. I mentioned before, we have chemists, we have geologists, we have physical oceanographers. So I fall into the ocean engineering or oceanographic engineering area. So we design things that work in the ocean. So you think about engineers that build things for land. You know, we have computer engineers, we have mechanical engineers, chemical engineers. We have engineers that build things for different environments. So we focus on building things that work in the ocean to study the ocean.
Okay.
That's cool.
Because you're working at such deep depths sometimes, how do you test those before you put it on an ROV, or is that even possible?
No, that's a great question. So we test everything beforehand, and it's especially important if someone's going to use the human-occupied vehicle, the Alvin, because we're sending people down. We want to make sure everything is as safe as possible.
Right.
So we test everything in a pressure test facility. So I work at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, and we have a special facility where you can put things in a chamber and actually increase the pressure, and you can test things that way. So before we put anything on our vehicles, we test them, and we don't just test them once. We bring up the pressure, decrease the pressure. We do it a lot of times just to make sure that nothing will go wrong.
Right. Okay. That's what we'd like to talk about on the shows, is how you problem solve. When you're an engineer, you do things over and over and over. We had one person on there who her job was to figure out what it would take to break a rocket, so to speak. So do you do that, like test to failure with some of your things, or no?
We try not to.
Okay.
We have, obviously, there's always sometimes when things do fail, but our goal is to design things so that they won't fail, especially underwater. You know, one of the hardest things in the ocean is you're working in this wet, salty, high pressure environment. So it's not like I'm just designing something to work in my office. I'm designing it to work at this really different environment. So if you think about, I like to tell students, like, take your cell phone and think about if you threw that in the swimming pool, what would happen? So now think about what you would need to do to that phone, how you would package it so it would work in the swimming pool. So you've got to really think about, you know, what kind of housing, how do you keep it dry? How do you communicate with your cell phone, right? It's now your computer basically in a box. How do you get the information out of there? So there's a lot to think about in designing, similar to designing for space, designing for the ocean. There's a lot of different things you've got to really think about.
Sure.
Oh, yeah.
Can you give our listeners an example of something that you have developed, one of the tools or instruments that you have developed?
Yeah, so we've developed a lot of gas sensors, but I'm going to tell you a little bit about a different sensor that we're working on right now that's not fully developed, that I think some of your students might be interested in. A lot of people, you hear a lot in the news about microplastics.
Yes.
So people are really interested in where are these microplastics? And the way right now that people measure microplastics is you take water and you filter it, and then you sit there and you hand count it. And you can imagine that is not a great approach to measuring microplastics. So we've been developing a new sensor in my lab so that it will automatically identify something as a plastic and say, this is a plastic, or no, this is a biological critter. We've been working hard on that, and we hope that one day we'll be able to put that in the deep ocean. And that's required a lot of problem solving, a lot of new ideas, a lot of engineering. And that's kind of one of the things that I think some of your listeners might be interested in because they hear a lot about plastics.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So what other sensors can you design to learn about the deep ocean? Like, are there plenty of other ones out there that you are using right now?
So some sensors you can just buy off the shelf. So if you want to measure the temperature of the ocean, the depth of that, you can buy those sensors. But to do things like gas sensing, there's a few available, but there's not many. Some of these are still in their infancy. So we're really working on how do we make sensors that can measure these gases coming out of environments. And what we'd really like to do is be able to share these sensors with more scientists so more people can bring these instruments out. A lot of times we end up with one instrument and that doesn't get as all the science we want to get out of it. So we're really trying to move towards sharing instruments, but also, you know, how do you commercialize instruments so more people have access?
Right. Can you give us an idea of how big these sensors are? Because I'm trying to imagine it in my head. Can I hold them in my hand, or are they like as big as my arms?
Oh, that's a great question. Some of the first sensors we were building were so big that I couldn't even lift them. Like they're too heavy.
Oh.
Because the housings that we have to put them in are heavy. They're made of titanium. So they're really big and heavy.
Right.
So we've made a really big effort in the last few years to how do we make smaller sensors? Partially so I can lift them myself. Because then it opens up the ability to put them on more vehicles. We've got different ROVs and different AUVs, which is an autonomous underwater vehicle. So we need to make them smaller so we can put them in more places. So now our sensors are at the point when I can lift them. So they're heavy, but they're not like they were. So I'm trying to think what a good, maybe like a foot and a half long with a diameter of maybe 6 to 9 inches.
Okay.
Okay. So while we're right there, could you also give our listeners an idea of the approximate size of an ROV?
Ooh.
One of the ones that doesn't have the humans go inside of it. Are we talking about, is that a bread box? Is it a car?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the ROVs that we use are big. So I say they're like the size of your SUV.
Oh, so
first SUV. Time I saw one, I was kind of blown away at how big they were. Yeah, so they're big.
Oh, wow.
I mean, they can be a car SUV size. I mean, they're big. You can buy smaller ROVs, but to do the deep diving, we have big ROVs.
That makes a whole lot of sense because I'm picturing, I happen to work at a space museum and we have underwater drones that we made. They're 14 inches square, but going to the depths that you're talking about here, something that small would get thrown all over the ocean. It makes a whole lot of sense that it would need to be that much bigger.
And if you think about it too, we want to put things on the ROV. So the ROV is kind of like the workhorse, right?
Frame,
we want to put
yes.
instruments on it. We want to collect animals and bring them back. We want to deploy things. So it needs to have space for us to be able to bring things back and us to put things on the vehicle to take down. So it's not just the vehicle itself, but there's also like cargo room.
Well, so that's what I was going to ask. Are there like arms that come out of it that can grab things?
Yes.
How does that work?
Typically two arms. So we call them manipulators. And they're exactly what you would imagine. Two arms that can reach out. They have grippers so they can pick things up. They can turn things if something needs to be turned. They can, you know, they're just like your hands. Obviously, they're a lot harder to learn how to use. And they don't quite have the fine motor skills we have. But they're really designed to be our hands on the ocean.
Okay. So I just want to connect this to give everybody a very good picture on this one and for myself as well. Since you mentioned Mr. Ballard, who found the Titanic, in the Titanic movie, and I know that's a different thing, but there is an ROV that they use those manipulator arms to move things. Is that very accurate or really close to what,
you're actually doing? I'm going to have to watch the movie. I don't think I've watched it in a long time.
But you can pick up and move things. I think that's basically what he's saying.
You can pick things up and move them. And there's places where there's things deployed that you might pick something up.
Okay, so I'm getting really in the weeds. But when you pick something up, how do you get the samples inside the ROV? Or do you just like put them on the outside? Like, how do you carry the samples back?
That's a great question. So it depends on the type of sample. So it might be, maybe we want some ocean sediment. So then we have something called a push core, which is just imagine like a clear tube. And it has a holder on the top so the ROV arm can actually grab the top and push it down into the sediment, picks it back up.
Right.
And then there's a crate. Just think of like a milk crate sitting on the front of the ROV. But it might be a critter. Maybe there's I have a collaborator who collects tube worms. And so those get put in a special biological box that sits on the side of the ROV that gets, that opens, put them in and close that off. A lot of ROVs also have a slurp sampler, which is kind of like an underwater vacuum where you can suck up small things.
I love that it's called a slurp sampler.
That's a slurp sampler.
I mean, it's so amazing the technology that we can do. And then I assume all of this stuff goes to potentially different scientists who are studying different things for what they want. And then everybody gets to learn so much more about perhaps an area you've never been before, right?
That's true. And also oftentimes if a cruise is going somewhere, there might be a scientist who's not on the cruise that says, hey, can you grab me this rock from this, this kind of rock from this environment? Or could you grab me some sediment from this thing? So there's a lot of collaboration, even with people that aren't on the ship. The samples can be shared more broadly so that a single cruise could be providing samples to lots of people.
Wow, that is very cool. I am starting to understand why you were so fascinated early on and why you wanted to go into this. This does not sound like a job. This sounds like fun. Can you tell us about like maybe one of the coolest things that you have been a part of bringing back a sample of or learning about the deep ocean?
Sure. One of the most exciting cruises we had was actually this past fall. Our instruments that we've been using, we've always been using remotely operated vehicles because we can control them and see what's happening. And it's like running a computer. Yes. This cruise, we actually used an AUV, an autonomous underwater vehicle. Mm-hmm. And we put one of our instruments on that vehicle for the first time. So that was a big success that we could now send it out and it would work and we didn't have to be controlling it. But what we were able to do is we sent the AUV out for a 22-kilometer trip. And what we did is we actually send our information from the instrument back onto the ship. And so we could see live what was happening with our instrument. And we were measuring methane. And when we got to the site that had methane, we could actually see it on the ship. So that was really exciting for us because we could now send the robot off to do its thing and it could send back the information. And we could learn something while we were just sitting on the ship.
I'm a Star Trek fan. I am picturing in my mind, like Captain Kirk or Picard saying on screen and just being able to see whatever, wherever. That is really cool. So is there a goal for every time you go on a cruise, the scientists would actually be working with the ROV, but then you would also send out AOVs?
AUVs.
AUVs, excuse me. So you would essentially be doing more missions in the same amount of time?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that, we have different models for robots. We have the ones that are autonomous. We have the ones that are connected to the ship. And then we have human-occupied vehicles. Right? We've got different kinds of vehicles, and they serve kind of different purposes. So I don't think we'll ever switch to only using one kind. It's always going to be dictated, I think, by what people want to do, right? If I want to see the video live, right now I need the ROV. Okay. If I want to be on the seafloor, I need to go there. So I think that we want to keep all the vehicles for different purposes, but using what you said, using two vehicles for different purposes at the same time is a pretty exciting way to operate, is that we can send the AUV off, it can do science, and then we can concentrate on the ROV at the same time.
So you've done sensors. Have you ever worked on building an ROV or an AUV? I mean, those seem like fairly complicated engineering and design projects.
Yeah, so I've never actually worked on those myself. We work on the instruments that we put on the vehicles.
I mean, they seem to be, you know, even the instruments, I think, are amazing. So when you're putting your instruments on, are you told, I assume, specifics, like you get this much room on the ROV to use to create an instrument to do this and all that kind of stuff? Do they give you specifics?
Yeah, so the ROVs luckily are big, and so they have a lot of space. And because they're connected to the ship, they have a lot of power. The communication is simpler. But when we send about an autonomous vehicle, we're limited in power, we're limited in space. Obviously, communications is totally different. So for sure, when, especially for the AUV, they tell us, well, this is how much power you can have, and this is how much space you can have. And so that does make the design more challenging.
Okay. You knew early on that you wanted to be in this career, so you've been doing this for a while now. Is there a project? Is there some sort of ocean floor project or shipwreck, or is there some sort of a project that's like a dream project that you would want to work on? And the reason I ask that question is I'm a big fan of adventure stories, and the Ernest Shackleton ship, the Endurance, was just found. So I've read that book before, and I know it was sunk. So that's another bottom of the ocean story right there. I was wondering if you had some sort of, I would love to go or do blank.
No pressure.
Big pressure. I think that right now, the thing I'm most excited about is actually exploring with AUVs. So being able to put instruments on AUVs and sending them out and trying to find things that we didn't know were there is kind of where I'm really excited about right now. And part of that, I'm really excited about going to places we've never been before.
Yes.
And so we work on instruments to measure chemical signatures. So if we could put these kinds of instruments on these vehicles, we can start to find things that we don't know is there. Yes. So I don't think there's something that I'm like specifically looking for, but it's more of the, what do we not know and what can we find?
Being able to answer those kind of questions, that's exciting. Yeah.
It's the curiosity, I think. Is that what you think brought you into this career and takes you through it?
The curiosity, but also the unknown, right? Mm-hmm. What's kind of amazing when you're out on a ship is that you look around at the ocean and it looks like the ocean. And then you dive down with an ROV and there's things there that you would have no idea are there, except for how you have an ROV with video and you can see it's a totally different environment. But on the surface, it just looks like you're on the ocean. So I always find that thought really, really magical when you're out at sea, is that you know what's down there because you can see it with the ROV, but any ship that's sailing by would have no idea what's down there.
That is very cool.
Have you, this just hit me, there's oceans that cover the whole planet. Have you done work in all of the oceans?
No, I haven't. I work mostly in the Pacific Ocean, actually, even though I live off the Atlantic Ocean. Most of my work's actually in the Pacific.
Well, that's cool.
Okay.
Well, we're at the time in the show where we ask everybody if you have a challenge for our listeners. So do you have a challenge, Dr. Anna?
Great. I do have a challenge. So here's my challenge. So when we think about things in the ocean, sometimes we think about things that float, and sometimes we think about things that sink.
Right.
But there's something in between that. It's called being neutrally buoyant.
Yes.
So that's when it's no longer sinking or floating. It's right in the middle of the water. So I'd love to see if the audience could actually find something in their house or design something based on things they have in the house, make it neutrally buoyant.
So you can
do this in like your kitchen sink or in a bucket.
Okay.
Find some things and see if you can get it to be neutrally buoyant. And this is a really important concept for a lot of things in the ocean. When we're designing, we're engineering things, we might want something that's neutrally buoyant. So this is a really important concept in ocean engineering.
This sounds fascinating. I know I definitely am going to give this a try. It has been wonderful having you on Solve It for Kids. Thank you so much for being here, Dr. Anna.
Thank you. It was great being here.
Jen, I know I'm supposed to be Galactic Space Geek Jeff, but the more we have ocean scientists on this show, the more I am loving the ocean science.
I mean, I already love ocean science, but I just think it would be so cool to maneuver one of those ROVs or the AUVs, like what she's talking about.
Absolutely.
And then get to see all these amazing things under the ocean. I mean, wow, it's so cool. And then her challenge about making something neutrally buoyant. What about that?
I was actually just at a conference for space teachers trying to do this exact activity, and it's much more difficult than it seems when we get started. I can't wait to see what our listeners do with this one.
Oh, me either. So if you listeners, if any of you try this, send us some pictures, or at the very least, leave us a comment on our website, solveitforkids.com. Or you can always tag us on our social media. We are at KidSolve at Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And we would love to hear how easy or difficult this might have been to make something neutrally buoyant. Right, Jeff?
Absolutely. And once you do become neutrally buoyant, you'll hear us next time on
Solve It for Kids.